I'm Trudy Kerr and welcome to The Interviewer. In this series, I talk to artists, campaigners, men and women of influence, musicians, performers, sportsmen and women, politicians, businessmen and women, and anyone who shapes the fabric of our society. Darren Zamit Lupi is a professional photographer, an award-winning photographer, a published photographer. Darren started his career as a photographer in 1992 with the Malta Independent. Darren went on to study a master's at the University of Arts in London and turned freelance, working for both local press, The Times, and international press, Reuters. He has had two books published, the first of which, Islanders, documents the migration situation in Malta. And Darren has documented hard-hitting global disasters and issues, but most recently has won the Yiannis Bechrakis International Photojournalism Award for the photographic documentation of his daughter Rebecca's journey affected by a rare and extremely aggressive form of bone cancer and her death on the 3rd of January this year. Darren, so much to talk about. But thank you for being here on The Interviewer. I've been looking forward to this for a very long time.
You're welcome. Hi.
So listen, as I said, when I researched you, I was surprised at the questions that fired off in my brain. But I want to start with the cover image on your website. The image that the site opens out with is a hand reaching from the water. A migrant is clearly in distress. Behind him, another migrant is swimming to help this person who appears to have slipped through their life jacket. And I've been completely haunted by this image. Can you tell me the story behind it? What happened to the migrant afterwards? How did you get to be there in the first place?
That was 2017. It was Easter weekend. It was actually Good Friday that I took that photograph, I remember. I spend a lot of time on migrant search and rescue ships documenting what is happening out at sea, as well as what happens here in Malta. On that particular mission with MOAS, which is a like Malta-based organization, we'd been at sea for a couple of weeks. We had several rescues that day. The sea was very calm, about 15 miles off the Libyan coast. And this was a routine sort of textbook rescue operation, calm waters, no panic, nothing whatsoever. But the rubber dinghy they were on was so overpacked that many of them were sitting on the outer rim of the rubber boat. And we handed out life jackets to them, and then sort of one guy slipped, and like a kind of domino effect, you know, one guy goes in and everybody else follows. So within seconds, we had several people in the water. Most of them had just put the life vests, slipped them over their necks. They hadn't actually secured them. And this particular guy just immediately slid out and started going down. Luckily, we noticed, and I was watching it all through the viewfinder of my camera, and I saw what was happening in front of me, and I yelled out to one of my colleagues on the rescue boat, who was a rescue swimmer, and he instantly jumped into the water to pull this guy out, because they had been sort of taken out by pulling other guys out of the water. I was also helping to pull guys out of the water whilst taking pictures at the same time. It all happened so fast, sometimes hard to kind of actually remember the direct sequence of events. But luckily that guy survived. Everybody did. They were just shocked and wet, but they were fine. And this was Good Friday of 2017. Now, to carry on with that story, so 2 days later, Easter Sunday, it was a very different story. I think it was one of the hardest rescues I've ever seen, and very emotionally powerful, because we had a lot of dead people. You know, to this day, I remember sort of helping to sort of, you know, lift this, you know, dead woman onto the boat, and she was lying dead at my feet. You know, covering her face myself with a shemagh, which we recovered from the sinking boat as well. And it was very, very distressing because, you know, there was a kid who drowned as well. We ourselves recovered, if I recall correctly, 7 bodies, but we know there were many others of people who died because we saw the bodies floating away and we couldn't retrieve them.
Was your role as part of this operation was to document it or to assist?
My role is to document it. I am not a trained rescuer. I'm certainly not a trained rescue swimmer. I remember when that picture was published, it was published, you know, quite soon afterwards, online and so on. So we got a lot of flack from so many people, sort of trolls and social media, saying, you know, why did I take that photo? Why didn't I jump in to save that guy? And all this sort of stuff. Obviously, you don't sort of interact with these people on social media. You leave it up to other people to sort of explain to them what might have happened. And even telling them to read the freaking caption, because it actually says the whole story. In this case, I know that, first of all, the guy was out of reach when he stretched his hand out to me. It's something which happens in a split second. And I also know that if I were to jump into the sea to rescue this guy, not only would he drown, but other people would drown as well. Because if I jumped in, my life jacket would have inflated automatically. So I would have become a floating Teletubby in the water. And my colleagues, who are busy fishing other people out of the sea, would have turned their attention to me. You know, other people would have gone down. But, yeah, I was haunted by it. You said you were haunted by it. Yeah. I was haunted by it.
But so if that's the case, what is your role as a photographer and what makes a good photographer? Because you're the kind of photographer, from the work that I've seen of yours, that it comes home with those messages, comes home with that powerful deliverance. Is that what you are trying to do, to change perception?
I know. I think the most important role of the photojournalist, and here I'm going to quote a late friend of mine, Yanis Behrakis. We mentioned the award I won, which was set up in his memory, because he died a couple of years ago. Yanis said something really, really sort of perfectly to the point. And he said, if you've seen my pictures, you cannot pretend you didn't know. And you know, you can say the same thing about the photos of the Holocaust, any situation. The photos are there, they are proof that this happened, this is happening. You can't pretend, I didn't know about it, I didn't know it was that bad, or whatever. You know, that is not a valid excuse anymore. Whether you're a common man in the street, whether you're a head of state, a politician, whatever, there's no excuse for saying we didn't know just how bad things were. And that, I think, is the real, true role of the photojournalist.
Apart from the works that you recently won an International Photojournalism Award for, which we're going to come to in just a minute, what are the images that you are most proud of, aside from those?
I like to say my favorite picture is the one I haven't taken yet. I don't know. Probably my most famous photograph and probably most widely published photo is a very light-hearted picture of the Drostra, you know, the slippery pole thing that they do sort of in summer during the
With the rather large gentleman.
Yes, exactly.
Which is on your website for anybody that's listening. Go and see it. It's a brilliant picture.
Yeah, I mean, it was. It really went viral. I mean, it was published absolutely everywhere. You know, and all the major news websites around the world, like newspapers, television. I remember watching Have I Got News for You once on BBC, and the photo cropped up over there. And, you know, social media, and the number of memes based on it, on Reddit and so on, was just insane. It really, really went viral. So, yeah, that's probably the picture I'm sort of, probably the best known picture, which I guess it's okay. It's sort of lighthearted and it's good and so on, but it's certainly not the most important photograph to me. I mean, not by a long shot.
There's another shot that I saw that I absolutely love. You have a shot of Pope Benedict nodding off during Mass at, on the granaries in Floriana. It's a brilliant shot that tells a thousand words, but it's not very flattering for him. So how do you decide, or do you have to decide, on what image to take and what not to take? Is there ever a point where you say, actually, you know, that maybe isn't appropriate and that's going to offend someone? Because I'm sure he wasn't happy.
I'm quite sure he wasn't too bothered if he even knew about it, to be honest. It's probably some other people were within the sort of Vatican Communications Department. But, you know, it happened, and, you know, it was a public mass, and he did nod off. I mean, it's, you know, I just thought it was a cool moment, and I shot it. There's no sort of ulterior motive. But, you know, we have to keep in mind, you know, this is a very, very elderly gentleman. And it was his first morning in Malta, and we know he had a bad night the night before. Yeah, it happens to all of us.
But what's great about that picture is not necessarily that the Pope is nodding off.
It's the two guys
on the other side. And oh, and I looked at it, and I took a good time to look at it. I'm like, oh my gosh, you could just imagine the thoughts that were passing through their minds, because it's right there on their faces.
Yeah, and also one of them is tapping his hand to try to wake him up as well. I mean, I photographed Pope Benedict extensively, you know, when I spent quite a bit of time early on in his papacy, sort of working in Rome as well, and I used to go to the Vatican twice a week. He was a great subject for photography, I've got to say. He used to love playing the crowds. He used to love interacting and sort of joking around with them and so on, and he just made great photos. I mean, one thing he was known for is, you know, this Pope loved hats. And I remember there was one time, it was inside Sala Novi, I think they call it in Italian, if I remember correctly. And anyhow, photographers are sort of positioned on a balcony overlooking where the Pope sort of sits, and he's at the top of this sort of staircase, and then you got all the people down below. And at the end of his Wednesday sermon, he would sort of go down the stairs and sort of interact with people down there. There were a bunch of Italian civil protection officers, including some pilots, helicopter pilots. And one of them gave the Pope his flying helmet, and he put it on. It would have been a perfect shot if there wasn't his head of security precisely standing in front of him.
No.
So all I can see is the back of his head of security's head and the rim of the helmet around him. It was like perfectly placed. And it's not like you can shift position, because you, like, you know, 20 photographers lined up on that balcony, all with your kind of, you know, big sort of white lenses. And I swore so much. So this is, you know, you're inside the Vatican, and I was cursing, and, you know, I knew the name of this head of security, because we'd come across him before, and I was, no, there's no way he heard me. Of course, the other photographers did, you know, they were quite like...
Did anyone get the picture, though? Everyone was in the same position?
I know afterwards it was released as a Vatican handout. You know, you've got the Pope's photographer who'll be down there on the ground with him, and you got a wide-angle shot of it. It would have been the ultimate sort of Pope shot, you know, to get him, you know, putting on that helmet.
I love your story about the Pope. It's fantastic. Let's talk about a series of images. The first photo I ever took of my daughter, and the last.
It's quite a change of mood.
I saw that you had won an award for this, and then I looked up the images on the Reuters site, Wider Image, and I have to be honest, Darren and I cried. Not just because of the images or the account that is with it, but because I have met your daughter at an event some 3 or 4 years ago, and I recognized her immediately. Firstly, was Rebecca or Bex aware of the series of images that you were taking?
Yes, of course. Of course she was.
How did she feel about it?
She was fine with it. It's, we know, we need to go back a bit, I think. You know, the story you mentioned, the first photo I ever took and the last, was actually the second story in a series of two. Bex was diagnosed with Ewing's sarcoma, a very aggressive bone cancer, in October 2019. I remember I was about to head off to Lebanon on assignment, and obviously I cancelled everything and stopped travelling altogether after that. You know, for the first 5 months of Bex's treatment, 4.5 months, I wasn't working very much. But I would go to see her in hospital every day, and my wife Marisa would actually spend the night there with her. But Bex also used to come home in between her chemo cycles. If she was well enough, she'd come home for a few days and then go back in. You know, I really, really believed, I was convinced that although the mortality rate is pretty high within her age group, you know, she would be one of those 30% who's going to make it. I was always 100% convinced of that. Once COVID sort of crept in over here, and you know, the pandemic struck us in March, although it had been sort of in other parts of Europe a bit before that, it didn't quite hit us till mid-March. I remember one Sunday afternoon I was photographing migrants, in fact, who were landing on Malta. They'd been rescued by the AFM. Marisa called me. Marisa's my wife. She called me in a panic saying, they're locking down the hospital. We're going to get stuck in here. If you don't come to see Bex now, you're not going to see her till God knows when. I dropped what I was doing, rushed home, which luckily is quite close to hospital, so dropped off my camera gear and rushed to hospital and spent the rest of the day there with Bex, whilst Marisa went home to pack some bags, anticipating a longer stay. When I left the hospital that night, I stayed till about 10, 11 o'clock, but when I left that night, that was the last time I spent any time with her in 7 or 8 weeks. because they were locked in there and I was pretty much locked at home. Although we didn't have an official lockdown here in Malta, especially back then, I pretty much went into a total sort of isolation, extreme paranoia about everything. Now, I was one of these guys who would sort of like disinfect all my groceries and try to get them delivered and have a sort of a dirty area sort of in the doorway where I could sort of clean and disinfect my shoes before I step inside. Taking the dog out for a walk was a real nightmare because, you know, we didn't know much about COVID then. So you didn't know if it was something which could be sort of, the virus could be lying there in the street and the dog could pick it up on his paws and bring it into his house. You know, there was all this, now we know, irrational fear about it all.
But Darren, that surprises me because of your encounter with migrants and being in tsunami situations. Was that you or is that because of what was happening with Bex?
I think it was a bit of both. Also, you know, keep in mind that when I'm sort of working sort of on the migrant rescue ships or if I'm in a conflict zone or whatever, we're taking all the necessary precautions. We're wearing safety gear and so on. In this case, the enemy was all around us. We didn't know if it's in the air, if it's on the sort of door handle to the apartment block, if you're going to the sort of to the supermarket and there's other people around. Some people wear masks, some people don't. You don't know if it's safe to pick something off the supermarket shelf. It was crazy at the time. You know, that was sort of compounded with the stress of having sort of Bex, you know, very seriously ill in hospital and I can't be there for her. So that was really, really tough. It was very tough for them as well. I mean, yes, we talk every day on FaceTime or whatever, but it's really not the same as having that interaction together. Because Bex and I used to do a lot of fun stuff together, even when she was in hospital. We shared a lot. And suddenly we couldn't do any of that anymore. One day, my editors in London sent me a message saying, like, you know, you got time for a Teams chat? And I said, yeah, let's have a chat. And, you know, it's worth mentioning they were being very, very supportive of all of us, you know, throughout this crisis with Bex. And, yeah, they wanted to see how I was doing, making sure I'm kind of, you know, keeping my wits about me and so on. And one of them suggested, like, why don't you, you know, this might be a good way of coping as well, and it could be an interesting story. Why don't you document your isolation at home, okay? You've got a very sort of different angle from everybody else because you're self-isolating to protect yourself, but also to protect your daughter who's in hospital. And if they like, you can ask Marisa and Bex to also document their isolation, you know, using their iPhones. I mentioned it to them, and both Bex and Mars were very enthusiastic about it. They said, yes, absolutely, let's do this. But I would set up a camera in a corner to take a photo every 30 seconds, for example, and I would then just carry on doing my thing. It could be I'm eating, I'm cooking, I'm gardening, I'm washing the floor, I'm sleeping. And I started building up a body of work like this. After about 7 weeks of that, the hospital authorities have said we can now start to switch places. So I was going to be allowed to go into hospital to stay with Bex and Marisa would have come home. So I then had to do 2 weeks of very strict quarantine at home. Once I was there, the emphasis of the photo documentary changed because suddenly I had access inside the hospital. We naturally got permission from the hospital authorities. You know, we took it right to the very, very top. They imposed a number of conditions which were very reasonable. I mean, Bex had been, since before the pandemic, she understood firsthand the power of the media because Bex loved school and she was getting very frustrated that she was missing out on school so much. And she was pleading for some form of online education for sick students. Remember, this was before the pandemic. The media picked it up, and then the president of Malta picked it up, and the minister of education picked it up. And shortly afterwards, once the pandemic struck, the momentum was already there to have some form of online schooling. So Bex was one of the people who actually kick-started this, because before the pandemic, there was a lot of resistance. It was perhaps one of the only silver linings for Bex of the pandemic. Once everybody suddenly needed online schooling, she could effectively go back to school. And she started attending lessons whenever she felt up to it. And by July, sort of, Bex had finished her chemotherapy and her radiotherapy. And she was well enough to go home. And to me, it was fantastic. I felt at that time, okay, we've got a great story. We've got some great pictures, some of which were taken by Beck, some were taken by Mars. I obviously did the bulk of them. But it looks like it's a very hopeful, positive story. I set about sort of, you know, putting it together, doing the final edits. Together with my editors in London, we selected the pictures. They got a very good writer on board to go through my sort of journal and try to sort of, you know, condense it into a story. And we did that. And Bex felt really empowered by this. At the beginning of September, she started feeling a bit unwell again. You know, we didn't think it was anything too serious. I mean, we never imagined it was the cancer beginning to come back. But they said, you know, let's bring her back into hospital. And she left home on the 27th of September. I never imagined that was the last time she was going to be home. Not in a million years would I have dreamt that that was the last time she was seeing her bedroom, the last time she was seeing the dog, the cats, and so on. The original story, the very hopeful story, was published the following day. You know, whilst Bex was still at home and we'd finalized the story and submitted it, and in those couple of weeks, whilst it was being edited and waiting for publication, Bex and I agreed we would continue to tell the story. I imagined it was going to be telling the story of a long, slow road to recovery. I was wrong. No, I never imagined I'd be wrapping up the story quite so soon, just a few months later. But anyhow, once we were in hospital, so, you know, we carried on with it, and she was fully aware of it. You know, she had no problems with it. It was very important to me to always respect her dignity and so on. So there were times when obviously I'm not going to take photos, particularly sort of when she got really, really bad towards the end in the final weeks.
You and Bex had agreed to continue.
Mm-hmm.
Even when your story took a different route, what was the objective and the aim of this story that you agreed? You as a father, but also you as a photographer, because there are two parts, there are two aspects to this story.
Yeah.
You can see in the photographs you are a father, but you can also see that you are a photojournalist.
I'm sure it's a very sort of psychologically complex issue. I mean, one reason why I felt I needed to do it was a coping mechanism for me, but that's just speaking about how I felt about it.
You as a father.
Me as a father. I also felt, in a way, this was a great opportunity to help other people. In my work, we spoke about a lot of distressing situations which I have photographed. You know, we mentioned a small fraction of the things which I've witnessed. I felt that if I stopped myself from doing this, wouldn't that be hypocritical of me? Because I don't want to show my pain, my suffering, that of my families, when I've been perfectly fine with doing it, you know, with total strangers.
But that goes right the way back to the very first image that we spoke about.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the same narrative.
Absolutely.
You are bringing an understanding to people who cannot be in that situation.
I mean, that is the role, that is the duty, the vocation of being a photojournalist. It's a huge privilege to be able to do that. To sometimes, you know, be on the sidelines of history and witness history in the making. But it's a huge responsibility as well.
But let's bring that full circle once again, because you took that photograph of the migrant as that migrant looked like they were drowning.
Yeah.
The last photograph that you take is of your wife crying over Bex just moments after she's died.
Yeah.
And at that point, you're taking a photograph of something which I can only imagine was deeply, deeply distressing. Did you take that photograph as a photojournalist or as a father?
I don't think you can really separate the two. But I think in this particular story, it's very hard to really differentiate between the two. It was very, very hard to do, but I'm more convinced than ever that I did the right thing and that Bex would be sort of happy about it. And when we see the response to the second story, which was published worldwide, I mean, the fact that it was published in so many media outlets around the world, the amount of messages, you know, via social media or emails which I received is astounding, and they were all so positive.
Did that help ease the pain?
It did. There were a lot of messages which were very hard to read because they were from people who are going through similar experiences themselves or have been through similar experiences.
That is such that an emotional hard. Weight.
That was a huge emotional weight. And I did sort of ask myself, should I be taking all this on? Should I be reading these messages? Should I stop reading them? It was on the Reuters of social media feeds. It got the most interactions this year. You know, the figures are public.
Now, let's talk about the award for a second, because you mentioned something right at the beginning of the interview that I was unaware of, that Yanis Varoufakis was actually a friend of yours who also has passed away. So to win that award, the International Photojournalism Award, must have been twice as emotional.
Definitely. Now, Yanis is not a guy who I knew well. You know, I only met him like 3 or 4 times, but we often spoke via emails because he worked a lot on migration as well. And the reason he used to come to Malta was to get onto migrant rescue ships himself, and that is where we sort of usually met. He was Reuters' fireman. You know, whenever there was a really hairy, dangerous situation, he was the guy who went into it. He had 9 lives. And, you know, every conflict you can think of, he was there in the thick of it. But he was a great guy. He had a great sense of humanity, of right and wrong. He won a Pulitzer for his work on the migration in the Aegean. Yeah, I respected him so much. He was such an inspiration. I remember the last time we met, we were having a sort of a coffee down on the Vittoriosa waterfront in one of the cafe restaurants over there. He was about to go off out to sea on with one of the migrant rescue NGOs. And, you know, we were talking about sort of, you know, plans for the future, you know, what we're thinking of covering. This was a very short while before he realized he had cancer himself. And we were both talking glowingly about our daughters, who were both named Rebecca. His daughter is Rebecca. She's slightly younger than my Rebecca. Yeah, a few months later, I remember, so I went to Brussels I was nominated for an award in Brussels. It was the Mediterranean Journalism Award. And I looked at who the other nominees were the day before, and I saw he was on the nominee list as well. And I said, like, gosh, I've come up against Yanis. Like, you know, it's his. I don't stand a chance, obviously. And I asked the organizers, you know, when does Yanis get here? And they told me he's not coming because he's not well. But I thought, you know, he's not well. Maybe he's got the flu or something. It was the middle of winter. I was only a couple of days later when I was talking to my editor in London, and I told him, like, you know, Yanis couldn't come. And he said, yeah, you know, Yanis, you know, he's got cancer. And, you know, that was quite a shock. And, you know, Yanis passed away in 2019. Very shortly after he died, Athens Photo World, which is a big, you know, big global festival, decided that they would be setting up this awards on an annual basis. To win the third edition of it, it's an honor beyond compare. You know, winning it for the story and, you know, seeing the kind of the links with Yanis's own story as well makes it even more sort of poignant, I think. Yeah, I'd like to think he'd be happy about it, and that, you know, he's had a bit of a chat with Bex about it as well, I would like to think. I mean, this is what I tell myself. There's no way of knowing, of course, but this is what I say to myself.
I think that's the most incredible thought, and hearing that part of the story about the background behind the award is even more powerful.
Absolutely.
Darren, I want to thank you for being so honest and so upfront in what must be a very difficult subject to talk about. And I also want to thank you for having that power in your photographs, not just of Bex, but also the other photographs that you've taken, to changing people's perceptions and changing how people see the world. It's an incredible gift. And I want to say thank you for doing that. And thank you for being with me on The Interviewer. I wish you all the very best. And I love the thought that Yanis is there talking with Bex, both of them very, very proud of you.
Thank you. Thanks.
To listen to this edition of The Interviewer again, or other exciting interviews, head towards Spotify or SoundCloud and search for The Interviewer.